Hello, and welcome to the Game Slave Podcast, episode 144. I'm Proteus.
I'm Assimilator.
And I'm Zelda Queen.
And this week, we watched a bit of anime.
I went to a summit about anime.
And we played D&D.
Well, I finished Tomb Raider and posted a review on it.
That's good.
So, let's go ahead and start with the summit. After trying to do numerous searches, the people at the Rocky Mountain Anime Association found that there had never been any sort of summits between Japan and America trying to find out why anime is so popular here in North America. So they decided to call this the first ever event of its kind, which, since I couldn't find anything after a few days of searching, I'd have to agree with that. So what it was SANA, the Summit on Anime in North America. And they were trying to find out why us Americans kind of have leached onto anime as much as we have. And why it kind of maybe have boosted from there into a global thing and so on and so forth. They had six different people there that did five keynote speeches. And if you give me a second, I will actually pull out the little paper so I can tell you all their names and who they were from and what they did. So we had Dr. Elisa Friedman, who actually teaches, is an associate professor in Japanese literature and film at the University of Oregon. And so she teaches a lot of stuff which involve anime and such. She had pictures of her students in cosplay and on a paper cat bus from Totoro. And she basically talked about how it culturally influences people. Then we had Christopher Bevins and Sarah Sullivan, the history of Funimation and the American anime fan, and they were basically talking about Funimation and its place in anime and how it's viewed and how it's seen it grow and fall based on their experiences as a business. Then we had Dr. Ian Condry, who is an anthropologist and actually works a lot in Japan and has been to several animation studios there. And whenever he would take his anthropology classes, he'd go around the room, and this was before he actually looked into anime. And it'd be like anime, 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 manga, manga, anime, anime, manga, for most of the people in his class and why they were taking it. So he thought, maybe I should actually look into this anime thing since it's most of the people that my class is being drawn to. Then we had Kevin McKeever, who is a longtime NDK guest. He is a member of Harmony Gold, which are the owners of the Robotech license. And he was talking about how you will find anime fans anywhere you go. It doesn't matter how odd the location is. And he talked about what actually began the big anime boom in North America. And then the last gentleman was Jerry Beck. And he was one of the people that, he owned the studio that initially distributed Akira here in the States. He also had a number of other ones. Let's see. He started his career film working at MGM UA, Orion Classics, Canon Films, and Expanded Entertainment before starting his own company, Streamline Pictures, in 1998, which was the first U.S. distributor to import anime features. He's also done some Miyazaki films, and he had some other random ones in his presentation of stuff that, I mean, it wasn't necessarily off the wall, but it wasn't stuff that people, that the theaters ever wanted to show. He had a really hard time to convince people to do the shows. And then once he actually got them to convince them, they'd go to him and it's like, we didn't want this in the first place, we thought it was a bad idea. But you filled an entire theater with people that had never been to our theater before. So it's kind of a, I hate it when you're right admission thing. And like the United Artists thing, he spoke on how when he was working there, he tried to get them to show anime, anime films with the United Artists, because this was before there was home video and such, so you would have to broadcast it. Mm-hmm. And they told him never to bring any of that in again. And since then, the same people that told him that have apologized for that statement. But it was a fun summit. It lasted from about 9:30 a.m. when it got started to about 6:30 p.m., involved the keynotes and then a roundtable discussion / panel Q&A. Mm-hmm. And basically one of the things they discovered was one of the things people liked most about anime is it doesn't talk down to you like typical American animation does. It actually involves you on a higher mental level than typical cartoons did at the time. And even some of the cartoons now that you see on Saturday mornings, they're getting better, but still. And I think we talked about this when we went out to dinner the other day. It allows you to, it takes you to places which aren't really feasible for a real life show. And that's a very short summation of everything. I have a bunch of notes, so I'm going to put it up there. And, the Rocky Mountain Anime Association recorded the entire thing and are going to be posting it online.
Well, that's good.
So people can watch this, but there was a lot of interesting things. Kevin had had an interesting story about, as I was saying, he was saying how what actually started the anime boom and how it actually started in Washington, D.C., when they rose the prime rate to above 18% to combat stagflation. And that made the American, it made it so the one American dollar was equal to like 218 yen.
Whoa.
Now, keeping in mind, now it's like 1 to 80 yen currently. Yeah. So, give you a little example of how strong it was then. So that made a lot of Japanese people want to bring stuff to the States because it was worth a lot to them. And that started bringing the anime over. And then he went on talking about how finding the anime fan wherever you go. He was in DC and he was in this, you know, mahogany cube farm sitting near the receptionist waiting for the person that to see him that he was there for. And he wanted to go to the restroom and the lady could see the giant robot, but she couldn't see the banner of the anime on his show that it was Robotech. So she just has like, "So, what are you working in? Is that video games or something?" It's like, "Oh no, I work in anime." Insert fangirl scream here. Two heads pop out from the cube format looking around. What the heck was that? So she starts fangirling over the fact that he works in the series, and then she starts going, like, "Now, there's this one show. You may not remember it or anything like that, but it was called Robotech. And it was one of my favorite shows." So then he introduces himself and what he actually does in the anime industry. Insert fangirl scream two. And a few more heads pop up over the cube farm. So he had some Robotech. Apparently he takes Robotech stuff with him everywhere because he never knows where he'll find a fan. So he signed some stuff for her and gave it to her. And then as he's walking, as the person that was actually ready to see him, he's walking down, everybody just kind of looks out of their cubes. It's like, what was going on in there? So, example of, you will find an anime fan in the most unlikeliest of places. And that's partially because of its wide appeal that we found and how accepting the anime community is. It's like, typically it's like, "Oh, I like anime. Cool, you're in." There's no prerequisites to it. And one thing that I kind of liked, mainly because it's the same go-to anime for me for introducing people, the Funimation lady said she used Trigun to introduce people to anime.
I always liked Cowboy Bebop. I thought it was...
For people who always just think that anime is like...
Well, because you get to the end of Trigun, it's like, what, they're plants? What?
But throughout, it's like, if you only watch the first few... if you only get to watch the first few episodes or only have time to show them to that, you have serious, funny, but down-to-earth all in the same few episodes. So Trigun's usually my go-to, because they always explore a show. It's like, think of it as a Western anime.
Space Western.
Space Western. But I mean, it's, you know, giant desert planet, basically. And it just seems, they seem to kind of treat things as a Western for the most part of the show. Cowboy Bebop's my second, but I use Trigun for my typical intro.
Yeah, Bebop's just mine, just because most people, when they think about it, they're like, "Oh, animated stuff is all just for kids and such." And Bebop's one of those that's like, no, this is definitely aimed for a mature audience, not necessarily because it's extremely graphic or sexual or anything like that. It just deals with, you know, truth, you know, more evolved themes and more interesting, you know, very in-depth characters, because they're actually all, you know, full-fledged adults. They're not like little 12-year-olds, you know, figuring out what they want. They're at least adults who might not still have figured out exactly what they're doing, but they're interesting. And the dub, it's one of the first dubs I felt like, oh my gosh, it's a well-done dub. This is, you know, there are well-done dubs. I don't know, I think the dub versus sub thing is kind of...
Well, it's almost pointless now, because with DVDs, it's like, you don't like the dub, hit a button, and you change to Japanese language with the subtitles.
Yeah, I mean, you can watch both. And in some cases, I know Pioneer has actually said, like, the dub for El Hazard, the English dub is better to them than the original Japanese. The creators prefer the English dub because they felt like they kind of, I don't know, I think
captured the essence a little better.
Yeah.
Well, they said they did rather good at adapting you know, the weird sort of Japanese wordplay jokes into
stuff that would
stuff
work
that makes sense in English.
Yeah, and then they also talk about how, you know, going on the kid thing, anime is a safe way for kids to confront things in real life that you would normally try to shield them from, such as in Summer Wars, about, spoiler alert if you haven't seen it yet, although I think I hit the statute of limits on spoilers for Summer Wars because it's been out a few years. And part of it, their matron dies through, like, halfway through the movie of natural causes. Well, this one lady brought up the point, is like, yeah, when we were watching that, my daughter asked me, it's like, does this mean my grandma's going to die someday? Well, yeah, it will happen someday. So it allows her to mentally prepare for that in a safe way instead of just being confronted with it all at once. I mean, anime can be a kind of a learning experience also culturally, because I guess My Neighbor Totoro, there's a scene in it where this dad is bathing with his two daughters. And initially when they were going to bring it over, the people that were going to
distribute,
thank you, wanted that scene edited out. And the company that had it said, no, we're not going to do that. And as much as he would have said that he was upholding the artist's integrity, it was really he didn't want to take the 6 months to edit out the scene. But then, you know, it finally makes it over here, and nobody really cared about that scene. Because it's a cultural thing. And even, you know, again, same lady with her young kids, it's like, hey, isn't that weird that dad's doing that? Well, it's a cultural thing. It's just the way they do things. Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I don't find it weird because it's a parent with their kids.
But, I mean, some people might find it odd. Other people are worrying about it being, you know, viewed in a very negative format, but people didn't care. So this is the case of, you know, studio worrying too much about something. But, I mean, basically, it was a great summit. I really enjoyed it. I'm going to put the link to it, to the podcast, once it's posted up on the site so everybody can watch it at their leisure. I am hoping that they manage to do this again sometime. I think they were hoping to try and do it again in another year. And they want people to keep the conversation going. What do you like about anime? And then, like, if you guys want to, you can send that over to us at The Game Slave, mail@thegameslave.com, and I'll pass it on to them, because they want to keep this conversation going. They want to keep evolving what it is about anime that we like. And, you know, keep the media coming to the States.
Yeah, because there's not so many guys releasing it anymore.
We've got Funimation. I think Media Blasters is still around.
Oh, there's Right Stuff now, but they've picked up mostly a lot of stuff that's kind of expired from other things.
Right Stuff, I think, is actually like a storefront. They're not really a distributor.
Okay, because they have stuff that I can't get anyplace else.
Yeah, they're a storefront. They basically warehouse a bunch of anime.
But they...
Because they sell a bunch of... They sell stuff like from...
So they're selling stuff that's out of print.
Well, like, they also sell stuff... They sell new stuff, too. Because, like, they sell stuff from Funimation and stuff from Sentai Filmworks.
Okay. Because I picked up Elhazard the Wanderers. Because I had it originally on VHS. And I was like, man, I wish I could have gotten it in DVD. But they never really officially released it on DVD. It wasn't until later that they did. And it was, you know, a nice box set. Oh, darn it. Is it just a poster there? Mostly because I just have to ask because it's The Rose of Versailles, which is an anime I have...
There it is, it's
$30. They're actually releasing it?
Yeah.
Okay, Rose of Versailles is basically the basis for a lot of Utena. It is. It's about a girl who basically takes... Her name is Oscar, and she chooses to become, you know, basically part of the court guard of France.
So, yeah, there you go. You can head over to Write Stuff and get that for $30.
Part one. See, but it's stuff like that. I mean, it's never been released. Who is releasing it?
And it's on sale right now, so you better get it in the next 3 days.
See, that's the thing. Who's releasing it? What studio is releasing it? That's why I was like, I think Write Stuff is not just a storefront, because where did they get it? Because no other studios had it.
Nozomi, Lucky Pinter, Lucky Penny. Yeah, publisher is Nozomi/Lucky Penny.
Hmm. So is it just English subtitles?
English subtitles.
Yeah, I think
they haven't dubbed it, but at least it's there for you.
Yeah. Because I've always been wanting to watch it, because I've heard it's really good in any case. Yeah. And it's an early, early one. It's from, like, the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah. Zelda Queen, you should put a link up to that article you were reading last night about,
Oh, about magical girls.
Yep.
Don't laugh at the magical girls! I should. I found it on Tumblr, and it's basically talking about anime in the sort of fact that it's one of those things that there's actually stuff that have feminine, you know, protagonists, which most shows are mostly boy-aimed. It's one of the very, you know, it's shows that are girl-aimed, and it's, you know, girls, and girls who are not... Yes, there's a little bit of, you know, hybridization with Sailor Moon, because they all have, like, short skirts, and they all have jewelry, and, you know, makeup and whatnot, but they also, you know, Usagi, who's the heroine, is a klutz crybaby who doesn't get very good grades, but she's very loyal to her friends, and she's sweet and kind, and always assumes the best in people first. And she has to be everything, and she does it well, and she doesn't, you know, she sometimes wishes she could just be normal, but she takes it in stride and says, no, I have to do this. And all her other friends are all different, too. They all have their strengths and weaknesses. I mean, they're more like real people. And so this is basically this girl's, like, discussion of why she thinks the magical girl genre works and what it sort of encompasses. And also what it's sort of, you know, entailing. Like, she also does Madoka Magica as well. And it was a really, I thought her, you know, really good dissertation of, you know, sort of females in general and the female story. Because it's hard. I think it's just one of those things, like, I was just recently right now trolling around looking for Sailor Moon info for the new season, like, the new reboot is supposed to start, like, in June or July of this year in Japan. There has been, like, zero information released. There's been, like, no production stills, no...
It's nothing. Like, it's such a popular brand that just knowing that it's coming, they probably don't need to do much, you know...
They don't even do much hype, but you kind of... It makes you feel a little leery, too. It's like, are they actually going to release it in time? Because this is the 20th year anniversary of Sailor Moon. That's why they were... Part of the reason why they're rebooting it. But also, it never died. Like, yeah. You know, people, the fandom of it never died. Like, yeah. The gal who wrote this dissertation is younger than me.
But that's my point, is that with, like, the power of the brand is such that they essentially don't need to advertise it. It's like...
No, but you still want to see that they're doing something.
Well, it's like, Kevin, one of the other things he said about Robotech during his panel was that Warner Brothers and, the company he works for and, Tobey Maguire, is all set to create the Robotech movie, and Toby's going to produce.
Thank God.
So yeah, Tobey Maguire is going to produce the series, but he's not, and they've signed on a director. They're getting the script all figured out. So yeah, Robotech movie coming sometime.
There's also, what was that on Wikipedia that we saw, that they're supposedly working on a Bleach movie?
Yes, supposedly that somebody, live action Hollywood Bleach. I want to say it was Warner Brothers as well that picked that up.
I'm still kind of curious to see how the live action Cowboy Bebop movie, should it ever come to fruition, is going to work.
Well, I've heard that there's that Battle Angel Alita many years ago supposedly got picked up.
James Cameron has been talking about that for 20 years.
Neon Genesis Evangelion got picked
up. Peter Jackson was doing that.
Weta was working on stuff, yeah. And it just never came to fruition. It just had a whole bunch of production stuff. I've also heard that some studios are trying to do a live action Akira. But part of the problem is that they want to cast all of these people who... Akira?
Akira is very much a Japanese story. Yeah,
it's set in Japan. It's very much a Japanese story.
And the setting is essential in that case. It's not like... I mean...
They want to move
Cowboy
it to
Bebop
New York.
Is not... You know, the characters are not specifically Japanese, really. You know, they're... These bounty hunters. Oh.
Sorry, I'll put you down.
But, like, Akira, it's...
It is, you know, it is essentially Japanese, but they want to get... Literally, the casting call has been all Caucasian males. And, you know, females. Like, it's like Avatar, you know, The Last Airbender all over again. We're going to cast all the ethnic groups as white characters, but all the characters that were technically white as the ethnics. And it's like, really, guys? Really? But we won't go into, you know, more of that movie, too. It's just terrible. It's like, you can't do that, too. Akira is, you know, that's what it is. You can't do that.
That reminded me of one of the questions, the whole, these people are, the Japanese characters needed. People, a lot of people when they watch anime, at least if they're from the States, they ask, why are all the anime characters look like Americans? Question that I've heard actually asked to me before. So, the anthropologist guy actually asked some of his Japanese friends sometimes, like, so why did all the anime people drawn like look like Americans? They're like, what are you talking about? They speak Japanese. They look Japanese. They're in Japan. If they're Japanese, so that one of the things they brought is like, so it's not really that they're drawn as a specific race. It's just how you're identifying with them.
Yeah.
So I thought that was kind of an interesting revelation to be made.
I mean, they're dressed.
I mean, they have like blue hair or pink hair. You know, that's like.
Well, nobody in America has that unless they've gone to a dye shop.
Exactly.
Nobody in Japan Although, has that either.
There was a girl sitting next to me that runs. I think it was a convention in Oregon, and she did have a green stripe in her hair.
I mean, but that's used as a, you know, way of, you know, showing personality in some cases, depending on what hair color you're out. That's why everybody always knows blood types. Blood types very important in Japan. It kind of, you know, sets your personality for things.
Mm-hmm.
That's why if you always look at character description, it always has the blood type.
I always wonder that when they had, like, the Street Fighter in Nintendo Power. I was like, why are they telling me their blood type? Is that so I know what to transfuse them with later when they're all bloodied?
Yeah, I mean, that's a cultural thing that you don't... I guess it's one of the things that... Like, what? Speaking of, like, that sort of stuff, like, just thinking of video games. When I was little and played games, I didn't ever realize that they came from Japan. Because I had an Atari, and Atari, most of all those games were made in the States, and then we got a Nintendo, and, you know, my dad played it mostly, but we played it too. I always thought, you know, like, this stuff is, like, fantastical. I could have never thought of some of this stuff, and some of it I always thought was a little bit weird, and I'm like, why is it this way? And why is there this weird food in it? And why is this? And it's not until I finally got into anime, and we finally got the internet too, that I was like, oh!
I'm trying to remember
what it was from Japan!
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what it was. I finally figured out that Kirby was eating, like, onigiri and stuff.
Yeah, that sort of thing. It's like, oh.
I was like, yeah, so I was like, what is that weird triangle food? Whatever, it's still hit points.
I mean, it's stuff like that, it's a cultural thing. And once you understand what it is, it's not a big deal anymore. You're like, oh, it's onigiri. It's a, you know, Japanese, you know, snack. And that's why they, you know, I think they don't have to Americanize things coming over anymore.
Oh god, those couple of episodes of Pokemon where they're supposed to be like an onigiri, and instead it's like, it's this onigiri rolling down a hill, you know, it's triangular, so it kind of rolls, but instead they just like put a sandwich just like bouncing down the, it's like a sub sandwich, you know, really long and skinny, just like bouncing down the hill on its end, like a pogo stick.
Well, I mean, square and square, why didn't they just do a
like sandwich a burger cut or something? Quarter. I don't know.
Or cut in half.
Triangle,
it was really weird.
Triangle, yeah. I don't know, stuff like that. It's like watching Sailor Moon now and actually, you know, learning that it was from Japan, all this stuff, and going back and watching the dubs. They flipped things so the buses would be on, you know, the side of the road that they are here in the States. They would block out all the Japanese on everything and put on, you know, English titles. They would paint bathing suits on certain characters at times. They did that a lot in Tenchi. There's a lot of bathing scenes in Tenchi, dear goodness. I mean, stuff like that, and it's just like, oh. And they would always have to, you know, redub all the music and all this stuff. I'm like, now it's like, you don't have to do that. We know where it's from. We kind of like the cultural thing, because it gives us a different insight into things. I don't know. I kind of like seeing how they do stuff in other places. I don't know. It's different.
Okay. Well, I'm going to move on just a little bit, because it's technically the same subject. Since you guys have finally gotten around to it, Bleach and the wonderful first filler arc.
Two arcs! It's like, it's two seasons! Not just one season, it's two.
Yeah.
That can be condensed into one, maybe even half of one. My thought is like, okay.
For people that are wondering what she's talking about, they're at the Bound arc. Arcs.
Well, we passed it, finally. Last night, we finally got into season 5, 6?
Season 6?
Because one is the substitute, and two is part of, you know, the attack on the Sarietti, and I thought three was sort of the rescue, defending part. I thought it was four and five that are the bound arc.
The problem is that the arcs don't match up with the seasons.
No. It is part of the problem. And no, the other thing I don't get is the fact that the guys started writing in, what, 2000 or 2001, and they didn't start doing production until, like, 2004, 2005. So that's, like, at least 3 or 4 years worth of material that they're translating. Why do they have to have a 2-season-long arc?
Is he doing weekly or monthly publication, though?
Yeah, season six.
He's not doing...
You guys are on season six.
Yeah. I mean, if he's not publishing that much per month...
Yeah,
three at a time.
Yeah, I guess it's the only thing. And I'm just like, oh my gosh. I mean, they're trying to do stuff, and there's certain characterizations, and then that's happening too. I'm just like, really? I guess too, it's sort of like watching Bleach and reading a lot about, you know, sort of feminism stuff. I'm just like, there's barely any girl characters in here. Like, all the squads, like, all the, like, little... minion guys who, you know, always get beat up by everything. They're always guys. There's never any girls in the squads. And the only time you see the girls is if they're either the captain, and there's technically only two captains. One's the stealthy girl, and the other one's the Healy girl. All the rest of them are all guys or boys. Except there's one guy who's a wolf guy. I don't know how that fits in the thing. But, and there's some of the lieutenants are girls, but it's like Rukia. It's like half the time she's like, oh, well, she's... you know, weakened in a weakened state. And I'm like, why is it that Ichigo can get super beat up to the point of death and dying practically, but yet the next day he's perfectly recovered, but Rukia, she gets hurt, and oh my gosh, she's, you know, down for the count for, like, weeks. And can't do anything. And Orihime half the time, I understand.
Oh, she drives me nuts.
She's a gentle soul, but they just ride her like she... it's just like... she's gonna pick something sooner or later. Yeah, she's a little bit airheady, and she always thinks of kind of funky things. That's just her. But the fact that she actually has great power, but doesn't ever do anything, it never occurs to her to do it, but and she never, you know, even acts upon it. I mean, I'm not saying that every character needs to force and fight their way through things, but they act like she has no ability whatsoever.
Yeah, wasn't the Bound Art the one where Rukia got taken over by that thing in her body?
Yes.
Yeah. The entire, like, three episodes of that, I'm yelling, it's like, you have a freaking ability to heal people! Use it to remove that thing!
Yeah, it's stuff like that, and it's just like I feel like they kind of, like, deviated from a lot of the character stuff, but maybe that's what they are in the manga and more of the series, I don't know, but it was just very frustrating.
It pissed me off, that series. That part of the series.
And more of it just pissed me off just because I'm like, this is long, and it's boring. And I literally, yesterday, Proteus was watching it, I took a nap. I slept through...
She slept through, like, all the captain battles with the bats.
Wow.
Which was, like, the kind of about the only really exciting part of that arc. But I agree, it was kind of, I don't know, it was kind of exciting, but then it's kind of, like, very much of a, you know, a... floor wipe for all the bouncers, like, captains, like, we're captains. Bunkai. Game over, basically.
Yeah, I just, the only thing that we kind of liked about the thing was, the one Bount Koga, he was interesting, and he's the really bully guy with Dalk, the metal one. Just because he really, I don't know, he was the most interesting character. Like, he actually had good character. And actually had a purpose and was doing stuff. So yeah, I'm hoping that the next stuff is good. I don't even know why I don't know, the first season of Bleach was really fun. I really liked it. I was like, this is cool. And then the second season, when they first go to, you know, the Soul Society and attacking the Sarietti, I'm like, that was really cool. And then when they're trying to do the rescue, that part of it just seems to drag on to me, especially like when they're trying to, you know, I was kind of rewatching part of it, and it's when Renji is trying to save Rukia from Aizen, kind of towards in there, and Rukia just doesn't do anything. She doesn't move, she doesn't say anything, she just is just passively there. I'm like, where's the fiery girl who always, you know, kicks Ichigo's butt And here she is just like, whatever.
Yeah, one of my friends explained it too is there's manga arcs and then there's anime arcs. You guys just finished an anime arc.
Yeah. I mean, that's the whole reason why in Sailor Moon, second season, Sailor Moon R, you get the whole Doomtree series, which is about a 12, 13 episode arc in the first half of it. The only reason why it's there is because they were trying to give Nyoko a little bit more time to finish up the next portion of the story, which is why it's so drastically different between the first half and the second half of that arc. But it's a very long arc, too.
The good news is you guys don't have complete crap until season 9, episode 168.
Let's see if I make it that far. Sometimes I'm just like, okay, we could, you know, do this in a shorter time frame. I think I would have an easier time, too. We're watching it subtitled. The subtitle's not bad, but I think the dub is really good.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of like, man, I wish I still was getting discs so I could watch it dubbed. But the problem is they haven't finished dubbing all of it yet. 66. 366 episodes.
Yeah, it hasn't had an English air date yet for 366. According to Wikipedia, the last English air date that they have listed is episode 291 on March 30th. So that actually hasn't even happened yet.
That's next Saturday. So yeah, I mean, they're working their way through stuff, but...
They're a good 3 years behind the English dubs.
But the manga, the anime's ended, but the manga is still going. I guess, I don't know what more story can be told. I'm just like, this is epic. This is long. Okay, I feel like I'm just kind of rambling weirdly about Bleach. There's certain things I really like about it, but other things I'm just like, can we just speed this up a little? It's like fillers. Stories. It's like watching Sailor Moon. There's certain
ones. It's like watching Dragon Ball Z before they did made Dragon Ball Z Kai and removed, you know, I think they cut down, they removed 50% of the episodes.
Well, the thing with like Dragon Ball Z is that rather than making up anime only story for it, they just had more growling and stuff, you know.
Charging! I'm charging!
Yeah.
I don't know, I guess it's one thing that's kind of interesting, too. I mean, I can't think of anything that's like that in, like, U.S. animated things. Like, deviating from some sort of pre-described course, adding in different material and
stuff. Oh, I thought you were going to say the whole shonen, you know, like, fighting, you know, repeatedly, constantly more powerful people on your way through the story.
That's kind of how Bleach feels. I'm like, it's always stuff that keeps going up and up and up and up and up.
That's the shonen,
yeah, it's, you know, like...
manga and anime sort of thing. It's a constant kind of, you know, this is like this, it's this long ramp of the main character, you know, getting more and more powerful with, you know, little punctuations of nearly dying. Usually.
I know.
Or in Dragon Ball Z's case, actually dying and then coming back.
I feel like we're just really going way all over in this one.
That's alright. I'm gonna go ahead and move on to video games though. So, last week, actually, I completed Tomb Raider. Well, I didn't complete it. I beat Tomb Raider. I have a 93% completion on it, though, so I think that's actually pretty good.
It's pretty good
for not, you know, for not going back yet and trying to grab things, yeah.
Yeah, for not using a strategy guide or anything like that, I think that's pretty good.
I mean, I only use a strategy guide if I am totally, desperately, cannot figure it out. I'm beating my head against the wall, which doesn't usually happen very often.
Well, they're pretty nice to you. As you, I was talking last time, as you level up, you get skill points. And the skill points you put in different survival fields. There's survival, hunter, and brawler. In the survival one, there's one where when you do your survivor vision or whatever the heck it was they called it, it'll put stuff on your mini-map where it is, and then you just need to be able to navigate to where it is on the mini-map. So it really helps you find those collectibles. The only reason why I didn't get the 100% is there's challenges in each level, and I didn't complete all the challenges. Like, you know, get this many of this, set this many of this on fire, or gather this many of this.
That's, okay, if you got 93% just going through your first time,
yeah.
That's pretty darn good.
That's what I felt.
It's like the first time I went through Super Metroid, and I got a 70-some percent, and I was like, oh, I didn't even realize I had to be getting stuff. Okay. I mean, I've never gotten 100% completion, but I've gotten finally where I got into the high 80s, low 90s.
And
what did you have to do for the special ending of Super Metroid? Was it collect everything and...
You have to finish the game in under 2.5 hours.
Just getting whatever you need to progress.
From the start to the finish. I mean, totally escaping the planet, everything under 2.5 hours. I did it. I sat down one time during Christmas break, and I said, I am going to finish this game in under 2.5 hours, and I did.
That must not have been very much of your Christmas break then.
No, it was just one day during it. I just said, because I had played it so much beforehand. I mean, I already finished it, like, a couple of times, that I'm like, I knew where most of the stuff was I needed to get, but I also knew how to finish it. And I knew the boss's weaknesses, and I finally knew how to fight the underwater one.
Yeah, so they actually entice you to collect them. It's not just random collectibles. Because there's, you know, ancient artifacts, which kind of give you a little background on the island or history in general. Then there's GPS caches, which if you collect enough of them, it gives you a little bit more backstory. And then there's logs, which basically are from the crew you crashed with, people that were there in ancient times, like ancient Japan, and the people that are trying to kill you. And then there's also logs from people that went there in World War II to try and harness the power of the island. So they give you a point to get the collectibles, and here's something I really liked about it, because typically anytime you have something that involves points and traits, you have to think of a build. And you're limited to, you know, you have to select certain things, and that's where you're going to get stuck with because you can't get everything. They don't do that in this. If you're diligent, you can fill every single point, and you can upgrade every single weapon to its max. I enjoyed that. Might be the fact that I just enjoyed not being limited, but I liked it. Because I was able to fill up the survivor tree, the hunter tree, and the brawler tree. So by the time I was on the last level, I was, you know, had all the special abilities, like, you know, shoot some guy in the leg, hobble him, so, and then it gives a little icon over his head saying that you can do a finishing move on him. And depending on what weapon I had equipped, depending on what finishing move I did. Like, if I had the assault rifle, I would jam it into his chest and pull the trigger.
Well, can't you see?
This game just in general has gotten more
graphically violent.
It was very violent, but in her defense, they started it. And actually, by that point, I'm also fighting guys that are 2,000 years old, and they don't know why they're even still alive.
What?
Basically, I don't want to spoil the game too much, but... So I'll just do about halfway through.
Can we just say magic zombies?
Magic samurai.
Zombies.
Zombies. Basically, they're called the Storm Guard. That in 2,000 years ago, they guarded this sun priestess that had strange powers that nobody could really
explain.
And during the thing, they still don't get explained, but why you can't leave the island does. I didn't find the story to have a whole lot of surprises in it. If there was a twist, I saw it coming. But it wasn't a bad story. It just wasn't a surprising story.
Was it, like, puzzle-solving at all?
There were puzzles, yes.
But I guess I just don't know. I mean, my dad used to play the original Tomb Raider. And I would help him because it was just very... It was learning your way around the map, remembering where stuff was, and figuring out the puzzles and stuff. And yeah, once in a while you'd have to shoot at something, which wasn't very often. But it feels like this one, it's like, man, it's like, let's put Laura in the most brutal possible scenarios and see if she survives. Like, I've been told, like the description of some of the death scenes, I don't even want to watch them. They just make, just me thinking about them makes me squirm.
There are some pretty bad death scenes. You feel sorry for her. And yeah, there is more combat in it. Honestly, this is the first Tomb Raider game I've played, so I don't really know much about the previous ones. But I mean, there were tombs that each had that were entirely puzzle based. There was some puzzle based in trying to get to different areas, like when you're trying you go and save your friends, and as you're saving your friends, things go from bad to worse, and you end up having to do the puzzle, and there's a real sense of urgency to figure it out fast. But yeah, there is a lot of combat in it. It's about the kind of combat that you would expect of this day and age. Not necessarily PSN days, to be honest. My favorite weapon, even if it wasn't always the best weapon to use, was the longbow. They made it a really good weapon to use, especially if you're trying to sneak up on people because you could do things quietly. It also was, you know, eventually a really good way to get around because once you got the rope the rope, you could tie a rope to the arrow, shoot it into a specific spot in order to create a zip line for you. And once you got the more powerful bow, you could actually shoot a rope into rock in order to get yourself to places. So, I mean, the bow wasn't just used for to attack people. It's actually a way to get around the island. And I also liked how they taught you things. I mean, there wasn't really much of a tutorial level. It's like when I was initially climbing with the axe, I had to jump to another area, climbing wall. And then they kind of slowed down, letting me know, it's like, okay, you gotta hit this button or you're gonna die. I hit the button, and then it doesn't do that again for me. So it's like, this is your tutorial on that you need to do this in this situation. Have fun. But they do that several times throughout the game, where it's like, okay, we know they're not going to know what to do this first time out. We're going to slow time down to give them time to react to realize what is about to happen and what they need to do to survive it.
I prefer that sort of tutorial than, like, here is the hour-long explanation of what you need to do in-game. Okay, another qualm of mine, since we're talking about this. So much of the tutorial is based in the game now. And I get that. We're trying to be, you know, effective. But I really miss the days of really awesome, you know, instruction booklets that have art and pictures and, you know, backstory and explanation of stuff and all that sort of thing. I really miss it. And that's just what brought me, you know, thinking that. I was trying to look up some stuff for Pokemon, like what Pokemon trainers look like. There is nothing in my instruction booklet. It just basically says, here's how you turn on the game, here's some of the stuff about the game, good luck, and here's all the, you know, safety warning stuff.
Yeah, they don't really print instruction books anymore. It's kind of pathetic.
It makes me sad, because, I mean, as a kid, that was one of the things I was so excited, or even when I got older, I was so excited about getting a game, was because I wanted to look at the art in the instruction booklet, and, you know, see what, you know, sort of story parts it would tell me about and everything, and now it's just not even done. Because nobody's expecting it anymore. They just expected everything on the tutorial. And I'm like, really? Come on. Is that hard? Does it really cost anymore? Because you're really charging me $60 for a game or $30 to $40 for, you know, DS game or something. Is it that hard to make an instruction booklet with pictures?
You have to buy the strategy guide.
But the strategy guide doesn't even have, like, official artwork a lot of times. I'm sorry, that's one thing I really liked, you know, I think made me interested too in drawing art, because I would draw stuff from the instruction books all the time, because it was cool.
Well, speaking of books, you want to talk about your recent book purchase?
Oh yeah, I guess we can move on.
Boy, okay, I'm going to real quick, I like Tomb Raider a lot, I suggest you play it, 5 out of 5, look, I have a review up.
Yay, review! I bought the,
Hyrule Historia.
Hyrule Historia, which was released in Japan. And I don't know how somebody convinced them to say, hey, you should release it in the States. And Dark Horse Comics actually picked it up and did all the translation and the English layout and such. I gotta admit, for a $20 book...
It's huge.
It's huge. It's over like... here, add it to me. It's like 300 or 400 pages. It's hardback. I wasn't expecting it to be hardback. I thought it was going to be a soft cover sort of thing. So it's hardback. The cover, is really pretty, too, because it has, like,
the... It has the Gate of Time from Skyward Sword.
But it also has, you know, some of the stuff, too. Like, I think, like, the Song of Time is kind of inscripted on it.
Or, like, the Master Sword on the edge of the book.
Yeah, I mean, the production value in it is extremely nice. It was really nice, too, as they translated everything. It's one thing, I love buying art books. The problem is all the art books are always Japanese, because nothing ever gets released here in the States, and so I get to look at pictures, but with no explanation about stuff, like what they were going for and sort of things. I wish there was a little bit more about, like, older games. Like, Skyward Sword, the first part of the book is just about the production of Skyward Sword. Like, how we did character designs, how we did environment designs, I mean, yeah, the first 60-some pages... It's just that. Then we get to the history of Hyrule, which is awesome. It, you know, shows the chronological order of how these games go and what's the split and how everything fits together, which is awesome. I mean, this is very long. I mean, that's, you know, another quarter of the book. Then we get into, like, the art production from the first games, and
it's a cartoony Link.
Yeah, like the first one, there's like, you know, a few like the first one, there's like 4 pages of the original Legend of Zelda.
You know, that could just be they didn't document this stuff as much then.
That's the only thing I can think of is that they have nothing. Like The Adventure of Link and The Legend of Zelda, A Link to the Past, it is 2 pages.
They probably Link's just did not hold on to things.
Is one page. Is the main thing. Nothing got really held on to until Ocarina of Time.
And that's probably because, I mean, when they did the original ones, it was pixel art. When you did Ocarina of Time, you actually had to start creating art that's going to be then turned into a polygonal character, so they actually had to pre-plan this stuff.
Yeah, so, and then it gets bigger from there, because there's a lot more for Wind Waker, and there's a lot more for, like, the Game Boy games, and, like, Twilight Princess, but it's fun. I mean, at least, as an artist, I like seeing the sort of way they go through and figuring out how to design characters. Like, Midna? Oh my gosh, her designs are, like, all over the place.
Wow, she changed a lot.
And even, like, in her final form, she changed a lot. I kind of think I actually like the one before they made this one, but just because it's not like, oh, let's show off her midriff and, you know, half of her legs and her cleavage and everything. But that's another point entirely. But yeah, I mean, stuff like that. So there's a lot of that. Twilight Princess. Twilight Princess is quite huge. Phantom, you know, Spirit Tracks. Sort of like how game catalogs go. Japanese and, you know, English, you know. Well, this one's a European North American versions of releases and such, like the packaging of the box art. I have the rare collector's edition still. And then the very, very back, which you actually have to read as manga, because you have to start from the back of the book, is basically the prequel of what happens on Earth before Hylia, you know, does all what she does. At the beginning,
before the city ascends into the sky?
Yep. Like, what's going on and why Link actually helps her and such. So this is technically, this Link that's portrayed in the manga is the first Link. I mean, so the Link in Skyward Sword is not the first Link. He's actually a later Link.
He's the second Link,
possibly. He's the second Link.
Or the second, at least the second hero, if you want to look at it that way.
Yeah, if you want to look at it that way, he's the second hero in the Hero of Legend. So, I mean, it's a good it's a good little manga to read. It's sort of like, oh, okay. I like always.
Stop! This is the back of the book.
So it's like, okay. So yeah, for $20 off of Amazon, it's worth it. Even the $35 is what it has on the back. It's worth it. It's just worth it because it's hardbound. It explains all the Hyrule timeline. So I can stop having this discussion about stuff in my head and with other people and arguing. Oh, I guess we get to miss out on the arguing and how the timeline flows anymore, but
we get to argue about different things now.
Yeah.
Well, I think with that, I'm going to go ahead and cut the podcast here. We have made up for not doing a podcast last week. We really have. So if you want to go ahead.
2-part episode, because we'll not be able to record next weekend due to Easter.
True. Easter is next weekend. Have a fun Easter. Enjoy your time with your family or whatever it is you do on that particular day. In the meantime, you can visit us at thegameslave.com. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter at thegameslave, or you can send us mail, as I said earlier, mail@thegameslave.com. Have a great few weeks. Game on.
Game on.
Game on.